Hello, on this week's program we look at two concurrent Daniel Garber exhibitions, one at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, the other at the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown. As the American Composers Orchestra celebrates 30 years, Susan Lewis looks at how this ensemble has helped change the classical music landscape. We look at one man's collection of films and his effort to share these celluloid treasures with the viewing public, and Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of the costume designer in theatre. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from Deer Garden Associates, online at deargarden.com, the Pennsylvania State Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Daniel Garber rose to prominence in the early 20th century as an impressionist painter. An Indiana native, he studied formerly at the Art Academy of Cincinnati and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia. Garber financed his education by working as an illustrator, commercial artist, and portrait painter. After studying on a scholarship in Europe, Garber returned to Pennsylvania to settle near Lumberville, 6 miles from New Hope. Garber's scenes are rich with blues, greens, and yellows, and often overlaid with extensive surface patterning. Through these techniques, he created a style of landscape painting characterized by romanticized representational imagery. Though he received numerous awards worldwide for his work, Garber did not rest on his laurels, instead choosing to use his gifts to nurture the talents of others, spending upwards of 40 years as a teacher at both the Philadelphia School of Design for Women and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Two major retrospectives of Garber's work are ongoing. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts is showing works from the first half of his career, while the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown is focusing on the second part of his life. Lynn Marsden Atlas is senior curator at PAFA. Where does Daniel Garber rate in the pantheon of the great Bucks County Impressionists and later artists?
From my point of view, he is really at the top. I think he's perhaps, other people may refute this, they may say Redfield or Schofield, but I really see Daniel Garber at the peak.
What's particular to his style of painting?
Well, Garber was an exceptionally renowned artist, probably at the stature of someone like, for us today, you know, Andrew Wyeth or Jasper Johns, of that level of renown during his lifetime. He won most of the prizes at every single major institution. He was collected by major museums all over the country.
But he went a little out of fashion later in the century.
It's absolutely true. After there was a real turning point in his professional career, I think less due to the fact that there are two elements to that. After 1929, his work was less purchased. He was less fashionable. And really the reason for that is twofold. The Depression, and the other really a phenomenon of changing tastes. It's 1929 in the early 30s that we see the birth of the Museum of Modern Art and the Whitney Museum, which was called the Museum of Non-Objective Art in New York. And so the fashion for museums in terms of what was the new wave was certainly abstraction and influenced very heavily by European surrealism and abstraction. So, which brought in a new wave of abstract expressionism. So, if you will, Daniel Garber's reputation and his active collectors probably turned more to abstract art. And it's really only until the late 1980s and 90s that he has become again renowned. And this, of course, is the first retrospective. Kathy Foster did a wonderful show in 1980 and presented new scholarship then. But other than that, we haven't had a show, a retrospective of Daniel Garber since 1945 when it was here at the Academy.
Unusually for many painters, Garber was a very accomplished both landscape painter and portrait painter. Are there examples that you would particularly say are must-sees to people who are coming to the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts part of this show?
What's so fascinating is we have brought the whole show here in Bucks County at the Michener. We gathered 170 of his top paintings. There are over 800 paintings, by the way. 170 paintings and charcoal drawings, many from private collections, many from major institutions all over the country, from California east. This is right behind me. It is an amazing must-see. This is in a private collection, the Warner Company in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. This is called Tanis. Now, unlike the American Impressionists, who were also interested in light and reflection and painting, this is a scene of Daniel Garber. This is Garber's daughter, Tanis, when she's about 8 or 9 years old. And what's so wonderful about this piece is she's standing in the doorway, literally, of the French doors of his studio out at Catalasa on this incredibly abundant, bright, beautiful, luminous summer day. And you see the light and reflection coming through. She's wearing she's wearing a dress, and over it there's a little smock. And what you see is the light coming through this smock and her head in profile. Unlike the Impressionist, who really focused on seizing one moment at a particular time of day, Garber doing it in very quickly executed work, Garber actually worked on this painting for 3 months. Through the entire summer, June, July, and August of the summer.
And set it, I think, at midday, just judging by the shadows that are below her. Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts Senior Curator Lynn Marsden Atlas. Daniel Garber, Romantic Realist, is at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts through next Sunday. The companion exhibition at the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown runs through May 6th. With few exceptions, American composers have played a minor role in the long tradition of music played by symphony orchestras. Indeed, modern orchestra audiences have not always taken kindly to contemporary music of any sort. But thanks in part to a unique ensemble now celebrating its 30th anniversary, the work of more contemporary American composers is being performed on the concert hall stage. And as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports, contemporary symphonic music is changing its tune.
This is a performance of Steve Mackey's composition, Deal, for electric guitar, percussion, and chamber orchestra. This is new classical music. If that seems like a contradiction in terms, well, classical has become a catch-all label for orchestral repertoire, be it composed during classical, baroque, romantic, or any period, even contemporary. Although in the last century, Americans were composing orchestral music, it was more likely to be used in movie soundtracks than played by orchestras in concert halls. Even as recently as the 60s and 70s, it would have been tough to come up with names of American symphonic composers, with a couple of exceptions.
There had been a poll taken of American symphonic programs, and when you took the names Copland and Bernstein away, I think less than 2% of the music played was American.
Conductor Dennis Russell Davies lamented this fact over dinner one night in the mid-70s with composer Francis Thorne and decided to take action.
I liked doing American music. I liked the idea that there was this big body of beautiful works for symphony orchestra that not too many people actually knew. And I liked the idea that I could, with all these musician friends that I had studied with and who were colleagues of mine from new music groups around New York, that we would get together and make an orchestra. I was the conductor by virtue of the fact that that's what I did, and they were the musicians by virtue of the fact that that's what they did. But otherwise, there's never been much of a hierarchy in this band.
This band is the American Composers Orchestra, or ACO, dedicated to the creation, performance, and dissemination of American music, with a principal focus on contemporary music. It played its first concert in 1977 at Alice Tully Hall at Lincoln Center and has been playing ever since, although the sound and style of American music has expanded considerably. Back when ACO was formed, contemporary music had developed into a highly academic sound, which many thought was neither easy to play nor to listen to. Composer Jay Reese, a professor of composition at the University of Pennsylvania, describes the music of the time.
12-tone music is very hardcore. It's not just Schoenberg style, but things became very abstruse. Dissonances were, they seemed vast and to the untrained ear, very unorganized.
It evolved to the point right after World War II where composers composed impossibly difficult music that only a few specialist performers could perform.
Steve Mackey is a composer and professor of composition at Princeton.
And sort of been my mission to regard that as a blip in music history.
During this nearly 35-year blip in music history, atonality was considered by the contemporary music establishment as just about the only legitimate style, as ACO founder Davies recalls.
I remember being in school and someone came up to me, did you hear that a composer wrote a piece in C? And that was Terry Riley, of course, his famous piece in C. It was a scandal.
By the early 80s, this hardcore approach began to loosen up, in effect giving serious composers permission to write melodies again. Rees was a young composer when the American Composers Orchestra began.
It seemed kind of hard to figure out where you go from there. And it's very interesting to see that not only did we have new romanticism for a while, for an older, more attractive, romantic, audience-friendly style, but I think that was very quickly replaced by this exploration of other cultures, which, of course, in the information age, we're so good at.
The information and high-tech age has yielded a variety of approaches to classical music. Composer Steve Mackey found his way to classical music only after discovering his passion for the electric guitar.
Those barriers, at least for me, did not exist between legit instruments and popular vernacular instruments. It just seemed, hey, I really like classical music. I like the narrative of classical music. I like the sound of the electric guitar. I like the muscularity of the drums. There was just sort of no reason why they shouldn't go together.
Unusual pairings of instruments is only the beginning. When information, entertainment, art and music travel in milliseconds, and people move around the globe in only somewhat slower fashion, cultural influences on composers can be an eclectic mix, as in the case of pianist and composer Vijay Iyer.
I'm grounded in the American jazz tradition, but I'm also someone of South Asian descent. My parents are immigrants from India. I also grew up playing classical violin in orchestras. I also played in rock bands in high school and grew up listening to hip-hop and have studied Afro-Cuban drumming and played Japanese court music, worked with West African musicians and with Indian classical musicians and with electronica artists and poets and theater artists and dancers. So that's what my music sounds like.
Both Iyer and Mackey were part of the 30th anniversary celebration of the American Composers Orchestra in a concert designed to illustrate today's great variety of American musical compositions and focusing on composers as performers. ACO composer-in-residence Derek Burnell says this kind of concert reaches people in a more intimate way.
In these concerts, we're just putting the composer right out there on the front of the stage and say, composers are here, they're out front, they're playing their works. And I think it's a very immediate way of having the audience relate to what the composer is doing.
Finding ways for audience to relate is important, for as the music grows more varied and difficult to define, so does the audience. Composer Steve Mackey admits that this has been one problem with his career.
I don't fit neatly in the right bin. Putting the worst possible scenario on it, it's like people who really like complicated narratives and long journeys and a wide range of emotion don't usually like the sound of the electric guitar. People who like the sound of the electric guitar like a pithier, like a kind of a one mood kind of thing, which is what a song is.
This may be part of a new challenge for the American Composers Orchestra. In the 30 years of its existence, the orchestra has largely fulfilled its original mission of creating forums for and sparking interest in American music. It's commissioned numerous works, made recordings and radio broadcasts, created educational programs, and organized special projects and series around themes, all the while playing its part to nudge and nurture contemporary music forward. In 1994, it expanded its mission to include the music of Latin America. Traditional audiences can still be somewhat timid about experiencing new music, but that need not be so, says composer Derek Burnell.
One of the things that ACO does is try to alert people that what's new isn't necessarily scary. It can actually be exciting and interesting. And for everything that might be a little unusual, there's something that you can relate to and something that you can understand.
In recent years, the ACO has found new ways to reach audiences and encourage composers, says Burnell. One example is the increased use of musical readings, using the orchestra as a kind of laboratory for composition and inviting audience members to witness the process. In readings, the orchestra plays through a piece without group rehearsal. The the composers have the opportunity to hear their works played outside the realms of their imagination and get feedback from the players.
So I worked with ACO first in 1993, I think, or 94, when I had a reading with them when I was still a student. It was the first time that I had had a reading by a professional orchestra like this. It was very, very scary, but it was incredible at the same time to have these professional players reading my piece. You learn a lot about what works right off the bat with the orchestra and what takes a lot of time.
American music has matured to encompass a range of styles, both tonal and atonal. And the wave of multicultural influences might prompt the questions, does American music still represent something unique, something that needs to be nurtured and encouraged? The general feeling from these composers and founding conductor Dennis Russell Davies is yes. Despite its variety, or maybe because of it, American music retains a distinctive character that is now, perhaps, finally coming into its own.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The American Composers Orchestra will be in Philadelphia on Friday afternoon, April 13th, to conduct readings of new works by local composers. On Saturday, April 14th, the new works will be premiered in a performance with commentary from the composers. All events take place at the Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts in University City.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Deer Garden Associates is a landscape firm specializing in the design, installation, and maintenance of distinctive gardens and is dedicated to customer service. Bill Deer and his team of experienced professionals are trained in various aspects of horticulture and landscape design. Information at deergarden.com, D-E-A-R garden.com, or 215-766-8110. Deer Garden Associates is a proud supporter of WRTI.
Classic Main Street cinemas are now being used as venues for the screening of new and sometimes forgotten old movies. But there's also a movie collector in our region who makes many places his cinema. Jay Schwartz stands in a cluttered warehouse space surrounded by stacks of film cans. He's demonstrating how to use his projector.
In just a matter of seconds.
Once a tool in every classroom and library, now for many, it's a piece of nostalgia. Remember the whir of the projector? The dust that seemed to dance in the air before the image hit the screen? Newer technologies, televisions, then video and DVD players, mean countless film reels have been abandoned, left in storage closets, and sometimes even discarded in dumpsters. Many of these old reels have found their way into the hands of grateful film collectors. Jay Schwartz is founder, programmer, and curator of Secret Cinema. For 14 years now, he's been showing his films in bars, coffee shops, parks, and auditoriums. Though he shows some classic feature-length movies, the bulk of his collection is more quirky and eclectic, educational films, travelogues, and even home movies.
Sure, I worry about getting killed in automobile racing, and I think automobile racing is quite dangerous at times.
This is a promotional film called Profile of a Race Car Driver. Schwartz estimates it was made around 1968. The film was sponsored by the Firestone Tire Company, and it's about Indy 500 racers. Len Gersio is a filmmaker and collector himself. He's also an adjunct professor at Temple University, where he runs the Film and Media Lab. He's an admirer of Jay Schwartz's work.
Jay's dedicated to preserving films. Films that are sort of, I don't want to say discarded, but dismissed by mainstream moviegoers, mainstream filmmakers. Jay has a unique approach. I think he's sort of like, in my mind, like a cinema anthropologist.
With over a million feet of film, Jay Schwartz figures it would take him at least 2 months to watch all of his footage. 2 months without sleeping, that is. For Schwartz, the films are portals into the past. He's philosophical about the way his audiences react to the old nuclear war advisory films and movies about mental hygiene.
It's definitely history, and it's definitely history that's kind of hard to see any other way. As I said, some people have put some of this stuff on video, and it's used for stock footage purposes and sometimes for a cheap laugh. People do laugh, tend to laugh at anything that's old. I often resent that. I mean, I often show things because I think they're funny and campy, but everything isn't campy just because it's before you were born. The world didn't just get smart when you came into the world.
His audience is mostly young, people in their 20s and 30s. His programming is eclectic. For example, an event he calls the sugar-charged Saturday Morning Super Show features 1970s children's TV programs. Other times he'll pair a known crowd-pleaser with an unknown and otherwise unavailable short film, but one he thinks the captive audience will enjoy.
Sort of, I'm trying to expose the secret world of these films that other people don't show. I guess I try and show things that people wouldn't see if I didn't show them.
Hence the secret in Schwartz's secret cinema. He finds the films that have not been largely talked about. There is quite a difference between film and video, mainly in the quality of the image. But as digital technology improves, there may be a point in the not-too-distant future when even mainstream movie theaters will abandon film in favor of digital. One thing's for sure, collections such as Schwartz's are rare, and he has great concerns about preserving it. He has cans of film he dreads opening, fearing they may have vinegared. The film literally begins to smell like vinegar when it starts to decay. There's also the problem of his projectors. Parts are no longer manufactured, and it's difficult to find people who fix them. He's found solutions for now. For example, the lamps for his projectors are no longer made, but he's still been able to find old stocks. Secret cinema will continue for now. Jay Schwartz will collect and share his treasures as long as the technology and the passion of like-minded film lovers like Len Gercio endures.
I think there's going to come a point where people like Jay Schwartz and myself and others who have a certain love for the medium of film, we have to resign ourselves to the fact that more or less in the future it will be an oddity, a sort of a curiosity, like something you would see in a museum.
And you can find more information on Secret Cinema's events and activities online at thesecretcinema.com. Whether we like to admit it or not, we tend to make assumptions about people based on their appearances. The creators of theatre, opera, film and television also believe that much is communicated by how a character dresses, and so costumes are given a great deal of consideration in productions. The person responsible for overseeing what actors wear is the costume designer. Now, as part of a continuing series about what it takes to bring theatre to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer provides a behind-the-scenes look at the costume designer's role.
Costume design has been around for quite some time. In ancient Greek theatre, for instance, performers wore masks, tall shoes, and other garments that made them look larger than life. And throughout theatre history, from Rome to Shakespeare to the present day, costumes have always been an integral part of the dramatic arts. For a long time, actors supplied their own outfits, sometimes simple, sometimes elaborate. But today, anything an actor wears on his or her body, from wigs to jewelry to underwear, was put there by a costume designer. It might sound easy enough to throw an outfit on a performer, but according to Marie-Anne Chement, head of the costume design program at Temple University, that's not the case.
First of all, you have to be able to be a bit of a psychologist because you want to understand who are these people that you're going to dress. You don't just place clothes on them. You actually try to get inside their heads and dress them as they would dress themselves. You also have to be an historian. You have to know all the periods of history for clothing. So if you are given a script that takes place in ancient Greece, you have to learn everything about those clothes so that you can dress people as if they were back in ancient Greece.
Chement says that the role of a costume designer is surrounded by misconceptions. For starters, a costume designer is not a fashion designer or a stylist. Fashion designers design clothing to sell to the public, to be worn on the street, while stylists select clothing from fashion designers for, say, magazine layouts or red carpet events. A costume designer, on the other hand, may buy, rent, or have a costume made to strictly serve the world of a play, a film, or an opera. This world is created by the writer, and the writer's script, says Marla Jerglanis, is typically the starting point for the designer.
Most designers will pick it apart in as much detail as they possibly can, do as much background with the text.
Jerglanis, who's the resident costume designer at the People's Light and Theater in Malvern, Pennsylvania, believes that good text and character analysis are important parts of being a costume designer. One needs to be able to intimately understand the world and characters of a play before determining what clothing might be worn. In conjunction with poring over the script, Jerglanis says a designer also conducts a lot of research early on.
We all are crazy about, you know, finding any kind of, you know, photographs, paintings, you know, any crazy textures, colors, fabrics, anything we can find to pull together to start presenting our ideas to the director.
In general, a costume designer works closely with a director well in advance of any rehearsals. The length of time it typically takes to develop a production's costume design depends on budget, on how early a show is cast, and what kind of show it is. Temple professor Marie-Anne Chiment uses the metaphor of birth cycles to describe the different timelines.
If you're doing an opera, it's really closer to the birth cycle of a whale. It may take 2 years. If you're doing a play, it's probably closer to a horse. It might be 6 months. If you're doing television, it's more like a fly. You have about a day. So it's really dependent on what kind of personality you have as to whether you like to work really fast and stay up all night and do that kind of design, or if you like to have a long, spread-out process.
Costume design can be extremely expensive. It sometimes involves tailoring a one-of-a-kind outfit. So careful planning is necessary. For most costume designers, a central part of the development process involves putting the ideas gleaned from script analysis and general research onto paper.
These were like my second set of drawings. I think I actually, like, usually I start with like rough sketches. So like the first time
Richard St. Clair, who's been designing costumes for nearly 30 years for groups like the Opera Company of Philadelphia and the Arden Theater, has stacks and stacks of such drawings. These sketches, often highlighted with watercolors, paint, or colored pencils, help to communicate the vision of a costume design for the others involved in the production. A costume designer, after all, isn't necessarily the one who sews together a new costume or alters an existing one. These tasks are usually delegated to others. Although a lot of detailed work can be put into sketches, Richard St. Clair says costume designers know nothing is permanent about the plans.
This is a roadmap. This isn't the costume on the stage. This is how you get to the costume on the stage, because the real art isn't this sketch. It's that person in a costume on the set, under the lights, all at the same time. So, like, this is just a means to an end. You can't get, like, real married to the fact that it has to look like this drawing, because at the end, it has to serve the show and it has to serve that performer on the stage.
For example, sometimes an actor's vision for a character might conflict with a designer's costume choice. While the final say ultimately lies with the director, Marla Jurglanis says she tries to be sensitive to an actor's initial reaction to a sketch or in a costume fitting.
I have to try to be aware when I notice that reaction to be able to develop along with them and not to force something on the performance that I have already decided.
A costume designer often develops a special bond with actors, according to Richard St. Clair, because a designer has to become very familiar with so many details of a performer's body.
The things I have to talk about to people, it gets kind of comical. I always say, you know, by the time an opera opens, I know everybody's breakups, I know everyone's operations, I know everyone's, you know, problems about their body and things they like and they don't like. It's like I become like the confessor to everybody. Like there they are in their underwear and they start telling me like everything I need to know and everything I don't need to know. Sometimes it does enter into like too much information.
But with information about the show in general, most costume designers prefer to err on the side of having too much of it. Ideally, they want to ensure that the outfits seem so natural to the world of the play that audience members don't even notice that anyone has designed the costumes.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. If you're interested in seeking out the work of some of the costume designers mentioned here, designs from Marla Jurglanis are featured in Twelfth Night, now at the People's Light and Theatre. Richard Sinclair's work will be part of the upcoming Philadelphia Theatre Company's play Orson's Shadow. And the costumes of Marie-Anne Chiment can be seen next month in I Am My Own Wife at the Olney Theatre in Olney, Maryland. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Linda Golding, Ellen Kennedy, Christine Barbush and Dominic Mercier. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from Deer Garden Associates, online at deargarden.com, the Pennsylvania State Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.